Daniel Menaker's new book, A Good Talk, is about the skill and art of education, of conservation. I've just been talking too much about education. He claims that our ability to converse is what defines us as human and quite literally what separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom. Frankly, I couldn't agree with him more, although that may be a problem for our conversation. His book is published by 12, and I'm so happy it brings Daniel Menaker here today to have a conversation about a conversation. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And welcome to my talk show. What should we do? Chatter, banter, engage in overt or covert self-congratulation, or rant?
I rather like the second to last, which was, I think, about self-congratulation, because I'm here I am promoting a book. I think that's sort of what I've been ordered to do. So, but I'll leave it to others to congratulate me or not. You know, there was you said something about what separates us from the animal kingdom. And just this morning in the New York Science Times, there was a piece about chimps. Mm-hmm. And what it said is that they seem to have all the equipment they need to talk, but they don't care to. And the reason they don't care to is that, according to some MRI or LPQ or something, they don't really know that other chimps exist in a way, that they have a consciousness of their own. So
it's the sort of thing that we've talked about with autistic children. They don't have that mirror gene.
Yes, and that actually is an interesting comparison. But the fact is that in order to talk to somebody and have a conversation with someone, there's an implicit recognition that they have a self and a consciousness. And that's the beginning of social life.
Well, in reading your book and taking your advice, I felt I should start off by saying I've heard so much about you. It's nice to see you again.
Well, why didn't you?
Would I have been better off to comment on? Well, I couldn't comment on your tie because you don't have one. Or
bracelet. I got all dressed up. I lost my man bracelet, which was the occasion of one of the more insulting aspects of my book when somebody made a slur about the appearance of it.
The point is that you say that we have to find ways to start a conversation.
Yes, of course.
But all of those formalities, the sort of thing that we're talking about, they're often pretty routine, predictable, and banal, aren't they?
Yes, and they exist in I think I make the comparison in the book to tuxedos. They exist in order to get past themselves. You start with a conventional greeting, a remark perhaps on the weather or the decor of wherever you happen to be, and what you're doing is not necessarily banal. It depends on what comes after that.
But the alternative is to try to show how clever you are, or maybe that you're countercultural, and that might turn people off?
Well, it depends on the people whom you are trying to turn on. It seems to me that it can be very provocative and can end a conversation even before it begins if you try to sort of subvert the normal course of events. I mean, there's a reason for these conventions. They don't exist simply arbitrarily. They help to establish common ground at the start.
You also say that in order for there to be a good conversation, there shouldn't be an agenda. And that worries me a bit, because isn't an interview a conversation with an agenda?
Well, right. And I think if you and I were having an espresso on a corner, we'd have a very different kind of exchange.
Oh, you don't know me.
And you don't know me. And so we have to remedy that by going for an espresso. Yeah. I mean, of course, an interview is not a standard conversation. But I do think that an ordinary conversation of the kind many of us enjoy the most doesn't have a particular goal or a particular purpose. It has to do with knitting the social fabric.
Mm-hmm. And you say it should be aimless. I get a lot of digression.
Well,
but sometimes, for example, you were having a conversation and we're friends and I'm having a problem. And I say, Daniel, I have this problem. I've had situations where I've talked to friends about a problem that I wanted to address, and they went off in all sorts of other directions, and it was really very frustrating and upsetting.
Yes, it seems to me that if someone comes to you, a friend, or maybe even a recent acquaintance comes to you with a difficulty or a problem, and if they say so overtly, then you have to address that. And it's rude not to. And it's rude to say, oh, yeah, I have the same problem. Or, I mean, listen to the person and respond adequately to their appropriately to their concern. And in fact, in the course of most aimless conversations, certain kinds of concerns will come up because you begin to feel relaxed and confidential with somebody. And therefore, after a certain amount of time, you may take a risk and you may say, you know, I'm very upset about what's happening at my job, or mm-hmm. I'm very concerned about my daughter who is X or Y. And so it leads to productive exchanges. But the point is, it's not a business meeting. It's not a real estate sale, and it's not a college interview. There's no defined goal.
Should we assume that conversation followed very quickly after the invention of language?
You know, I don't know. I would love to have seen that transition.
We don't have tape recorders.
No, there weren't. And, you know, stone tablets don't really tell us very much about that kind of thing. I have this feeling that, and which is to some extent supported by the speculations of experts in the field, naming and orders came first because they are necessary in a tribal or clan situation.
Well, I would assume that it took civilization and the leisure that civilization provided to allow people to engage in real conversation. They had more time.
I think that's true. It's certainly the there's no question that the development of agricultural fixedness, where you stay in one place and you're not nomadic and you're not constantly fending off unexpected attacks from saber-tooths and so on, certainly played a role in writing and the development of art and culture. So I assume, yes, that you need to stay in one place and feel safe in order to have social life.
And you mentioned in the book that there's little conversation in refugee camps.
One of the principal characteristics, and one that many correspondents on television and on radio have noticed about the most dire refugee camps in Africa and elsewhere, is that they are silent. And I think that shows that conversation is not merely an indulgence or a self-indulgence, but it's actually part, an essential part of a functioning society rather than a desperate situation.
My guest is Daniel Miniker, who has written for many publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate.com, author of a number of books, and the most recent is A Good Talk, The Story and Skill of Conversation, which is published by 12. You say that men and women converse in equal amounts. Oh, that can't be true, can it?
You know, there are varying...
Have you told Deborah Tannen this?
No, but I address Ms. Tannen indirectly in the book because I think all such generalizations and statistics are very problematical and questionable, including my own, because, in fact, you cannot really capture a conversation between men and men, men and women, women and women, as it naturally occurs without interfering with the experiment. So... I'm very skeptical of quantifications of conversation.
But even if they converse the same amount of time, aren't their conversations radically different, which is the subject of Deborah Tannen's first book?
I do believe that there are conversational differences between men and women. I think they are there, and to some extent, possibly neurologically programmed. I think, however, that they are there to be transcended. And that is to say that after you get done playing whatever role gender has assigned to you, that you begin to become more natural, and a man and a woman together, or two gay men, or can have a perfectly normal conversation. In fact, I think it's almost a goal of conversation to escape the fetters of that kind of assignment that evolution has given us.
Well, what about those people who say that women are more spatial, men are more linear?
I think it's true. I want to say that in a very linear fashion because I'm a very manly guy. So I have no argument with that. But I think that men, in their possibly greater linearity, can draw from women a certain amount of matter-of-factness. Correspondingly, I think as David Hume said, women can draw from any group of people a more social and more spatial kind of response. I think it's a very elegant dance, a good conversation.
We can't engage in conversation at a cocktail party. That's small talk. What's the big difference? Other than most of us say we hate small talk.
Well, that's funny. In the middle of small talk, to be saying I hate small talk. I don't know that there is such a thing as small talk. You're right. There's certain gradations of risk-taking, confidence, honesty, and candor. And you're not going to run into that when you're standing up with a flute of champagne. But that doesn't mean that the exchanges between you and the other person don't have layers and resonance and meaning.
Well, there are all these subtexts. The other person can make more money than you do, in fact, be your boss, or be a person you find sexually attractive. And although you're maybe saying the same thing you said to the person before, it means all sorts of different things to you.
I'd hazard the guess that it's not exactly the same, and what you need
to... Well, I'm thinking different thoughts anyway.
Well, you may also be leering, as I have been known to do. You may be furrowing your brow. There's body language, too. If you're talking to your boss and you don't like him or her, the chances are you are turned slightly to one side. You're expressing it somehow. Every exchange is different. It's like a fingerprint.
And some people can read that better than others.
That's right.
And it's this is the body language that they're reading.
That's right. In fact, there are experts, FBI people, people in the CIA, who are literally trained in those very subtexts.
And when that doesn't work, you just torture them.
If you're John Yoo, whom I saw interviewed last night on The Daily Show, I have to say it was one of the most peculiar conversations I've ever heard.
Well, he was just doing his job as a lawyer, he says, which is something quite different. Why was it? Was it a strange conversation because he was on a different page than John Stewart?
Well, I think he was in a different library. it's not just a page. But what I wondered was, and I wonder about myself, is there no limit to what a writer will do in order to promote his book? The guy was on the show with an arch enemy of his, ideologically, to promote his book. And I thought, this takes some real guts.
Oh, we would have him on the show.
Although I'm
sure. We probably agree on 98% of all things. You also cover the history of writing.
Wait a minute.
About,
hold on a second.
That was a joke.
Hold on a second. Back up a little bit. Wait a minute. That's not the Leonard Lopate that I know.
You write about what different people have said about conversation over the years, but you also say you've come to believe that historians are all frauds. So should we even be reading those things?
I've had such a funny epiphany. I remember in freshman philosophy class, a professor said to me, prove that there's a past. And of course I couldn't. That this moment is this moment. We may have been created 2 seconds ago with everything in place.
But can't I show you something that a photograph of me 20 years ago?
That was similarly created by the great creator 2 seconds ago. Sure you could. My point is that the past is an amazing place because of its very pastness. You can't really prove anything about it. And I didn't say that historians are a fraud. A friend of mine, who is an historian, said it.
Yeah, but you said you've come to agree with him, come to believe he was right.
Well, the examples that I think I cite are that there are 4 or 7 or 12 different explanations for the beginning of the First World War, just to take an example, to say nothing of the American Revolution, to say nothing of the end of the Vietnam War. And it's very hard to choose among them. People bring their own constructs often onto the raw data of history. So I wouldn't say they were frauds. What I would say is that all historians are selective, and you need to read a lot of stuff before you begin to develop your own idea of what happened.
But when we look over history, the history as it was written at that time, do we learn that conversation has played different roles at different times?
It's a good question. In doing the research for this book, I must say I have found that certain things seem to be utterly true and not in a fraudulent way. One of them is that when the printing press was invented, conversation interestingly enough, became a topic of conversation, because for the first time, rules could be disseminated, and were, especially by Italian courtiers, about how to conduct yourself. There were texts. In fact, Cicero's essays were the second thing to be published, printed by Gutenberg. And one of those essays is about conversation. But what I think, I mean, my main point is that we, in our conversations every day, really are the historians of conversation. We create it. Nobody who writes a book creates conversation.
Now, Cicero's essay was on duties. Is conversation a duty?
Yes, I think it is. And I think people can perform it better or less well. And I sympathize with those who are terse and laconic. And I object to those who are garrulous and voluble. And I think that there's a happy medium. But I think
that's because you're not a talk show host.
Yes, but you are extremely good at balance. And that's even in a talk show, even though you're the interviewer, you manage to make yourself heard. You manage to make yourself known. And that's admirable because you do it in an implicit way. It seems to me a duty to be able to sit down and talk with other people if you want to be an active member of society.
So how does one end a conversation gracefully, especially not in this case, if you're talking to a bore and you really want to get away? You simply say, I have to go to the bathroom?
I think it'd be better to try to avoid that, although I say that if something's really bad, you can faint. I mean, not just sort of fall over or have a mock heart attack. I think to end a conversation is also something of a duty, and people tend to, as I say, diesel the way an old car does when you turn it off. I think that's a sign of decency in community, but I think that you can be helpful to a conversation by knowing how to stop, like right now.
Daniel Manica will be reading and signing books this Thursday at 7 in Dumbo, and then other times throughout January. For details, go to our website at wnyc.org. And so to close, thank you so much for your time and all of your insightful thoughts.
Thank you very much.